Side 11. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Fincham. Continuing on page 366. You knew what they feared, not what they wanted or what moved them. And you had business up country at the mines, so presently as the sputtering light slipped behind, so did all further need to think of them. But as you swung away, who was the woman alone in the earth, planted up to her shoulders in the aardvark hole, a gazing head rooted to the desert plain, with an upsweep of mountains far behind her, darkly folded, far away in the evening? She can feel the incredible pressure, miles of horizontal sand and clay against her belly. Down the trail wait the luminous ghosts of her four stillborn children, fat worms lying with no chances of comfort among the wild onions. One by one, crying for milk more sacred than what is tasted and blessed in the village calabashes. In preterite line, they have pointed her here to be in touch with Earth's gift for Genesis. The woman feels power flood in through every gate, a river between her thighs, light leaping at the ends of fingers and toes. It is sure and nourishing as sleep. It is a warmth. The more the daylight fades, the further she submits to the dark, to the descent of water from the air. She is a seed in the earth. The holy aardvark has dug her bed. Back in Südwest, the Erdschweinhöhle was a powerful symbol of fertility and life. But here in the zone, its real status is not so clear. Inside the Schwarzkommando, there are forces at present who have opted for sterility and death. The struggle is mostly in silence, in the night, in the nauseas and crampings of pregnancies or miscarriages. But it is political struggle. No one is more troubled with it than Ensign. He is Nguaroreru here. The word doesn't mean leader exactly, but one who has been proven. Ensign is also known, though not to his face, as Otikondo, the half-breed. His father was a European. Not that it makes him unique among the Erdschweinhörlers here. There's German, Slavic, and Gypsy blood mixed in by now, too. Over the couple of generations, moved by accelerations unknown in the days before the Empire, they have been growing an identity that few can see as ever taking final shape. The rocket will have a final shape, but not its people. The Anda and Oruzo have lost their force out here. The bloodlines of mother and father were left behind in Südwest. Many of the early immigrants had even gone over to the faith of the Rhenish Missionary Society long before they left. In each village, as noon flared the shadows in tightly to their owners, in that moment of terror and refuge, the Omuhona took from his sacred bag soul after converted soul, the leather cord kept there since the individual's birth, and untied the birth knot. Untied, it was another soul dead to the tribe. So today, in the Erdschweinhöhle, the empty ones each carry one knotless strip of leather. It is a bit of the old symbolism they have found useful. They call themselves Otukungurua. Yes, old Africa hands, it ought to be Omakungurua, but they are always careful. Perhaps it's less healthy than care to point out that Oma applies only to the living and human. Otu is for the inanimate and the rising, and this is how they imagine themselves. Revolutionaries of the Zero, they mean to carry on what began among the old Hereros after the 1904 rebellion failed. They want a negative birth rate. The program is racial suicide. They would finish the extermination the Germans began in 1904. A generation earlier, the declining number of live Herero births was a topic of medical interest throughout southern Africa. The whites looked on as anxiously as they would have at an outbreak of rinderpest among the cattle. How provoking to watch one's subject population dwindling like this year after year. What's a colony without its dusky natives? Where's the fun if they're all going to die off? Just a big hunk of desert, no more maids, no field hands, no laborers for the construction or the mining. Wait a minute there. Yes, it's Karl Marx, that sly old racist, skipping away with his teeth together and his eyebrows up, trying to make believe it's nothing but cheap labor and overseas markets. Oh, no. Colonies are much, much more. Colonies are the outhouses of the European soul, where a fellow can let his pants down and relax, enjoy the smell of his own shit, where he can fall on his slender prey, roaring as loud as he feels like, and guzzle her blood with open joy, eh? Where he can just wallow and rut and let himself go in a softness, a receptive darkness of limbs, of hair as woolly as the hair on his own forbidden genitals, where the poppy and cannabis and coca grow full and green, and not to the colors and style of death as do ergot and agaric, the blight and fungus native to Europe. Christian Europe was always death, Carl, death and repression. Out and down in the colonies, life can be indulged, life and sensuality in all its forms, with no harm done to the metropolis, nothing to soil those cathedrals, white marble statues, noble thoughts. No word ever gets back. The silences down here are vast enough to absorb all behavior, no matter how dirty, how animal it gets. Some of the more rational men of medicine attributed the Herrero birth decline to a deficiency of vitamin E in the diet. Others to poor chances of fertilization given the peculiarly long and narrow uterus of the Herrero female. But underneath all this reasonable talk, this scientific speculating, no white Afrikaner could quite put down the way it felt. Something sinister was moving out in the veld. He was beginning to look at their faces, especially those of the women, lined beyond the thorn fences, and he knew beyond logical proof there was a tribal mind at work out here, and it had chosen to commit suicide. Puzzling. Perhaps we weren't as fair as we might have been. Perhaps we did take their cattle and their lands away, and then the work camps, of course, the barbed wire and the stockades. Perhaps they feel it is a world they no longer want to live in. Typical of them, though, giving up. Crawling away to die, why won't they even negotiate? We could work out a solution, some solution. It was a simple choice for the Herreros between two kinds of death, tribal death or Christian death. Tribal death made sense. Christian death made none at all. It seemed an exercise they did not need. But to the Europeans, conned by their own baby Jesus con game, what they were witnessing among these Herreros was a mystery potent as that of the elephant graveyard or the lemmings rushing into the sea. Though they don't admit it, the empty ones, now exiled in the zone, Europeanized in language and thought, split off from the old tribal unity, have found the why of it just as mysterious. But they've seized it, as a sick woman will seize a charm. They calculate no cycles, no returns. They are in love with the glamour of a whole people's suicide, the pose, the stoicism, and the bravery. These Otukungurua are prophets of masturbating, specialists in abortion and sterilization, pitchmen for acts oral and anal, pedal and digital, sodomistical and zoophiliac. Their approach and their game is pleasure. They are spieling earnestly and well, and Erdschweinherrlers are listening. The empty ones can guarantee a day when the last zone Herrera will die, a final zero to a collective history fully lived. It has appeal. There is no outright struggle for power. It is all seduction and counter-seduction, advertising and pornography, and the history of the zone Herreros is being decided in bed. Vectors in the night underground, all trying to flee a center, a force which appears to be the rocket. Some imagination, whether of journey or of destiny, which is able to gather violent political opposites together in the Erdschweinherrler as it gathers fuel and oxidizer in its thrust chamber, metered, helmsman-like, for the sake of its scheduled parabola. Ensign sits this evening under his mountain. Behind him another day of schemes, expediting, newly invented paperwork, forms he manages to destroy or fold, Japanese style, before the day's end, into gazelles, orchids, hunter hawks. As the rocket grows toward its working shape and fullness, so does he evolve himself into a new configuration. He feels it. It's something else to worry about. Late last night, among the blueprints, Christian and Mieczyslav looked up, abruptly smiled, and fell silent. The transparent reverence. They study the drawings as if they were his own and revelations. This is not flattering to him. What Enzian wants to create will have no history. It will never need a design change. Time, as time is known to the other nations, will wither away inside this new one. The Erdschweinherrler will not be bound like the rocket to time. The people will find the center again, the center without time, the journey without hysteresis. where every departure is a return to the same place, the only place. He has thus himself found a strange rapprochement with the empty ones, in particular with Joseph Ambindi of Hanover. The eternal center can easily be seen as the final zero. Names and methods vary, but the movement toward stillness is the same. It has led to strange passages between the two men. You know? Umbindi's eyes rolled the other way, looking up at a mirror image of Ensign that only he can see. There's, well, something you ordinarily wouldn't think of as erotic, but it's really the most erotic thing there is. Really? Grins Ensign, flirting. I can't think of what that would be. Give me a clue. It's a non-repeatable act. Firing a rocket? No, because there's always another rocket. But there's nothing... Well, never mind. Ha! Nothing to follow it with. That's what you were going to say. Suppose I give you another clue. All right. But Enzian has already guessed. It's there in the way he holds his jaw and is just about to laugh. It embraces all the deviations in one single act. Enzian sighs, irritated, but does not call him on this use of deviations. Bringing up the past is part of Ombindi's game. Homosexuality, for example, no rise. Sadism and masochism. Onanism? Necrophilia? All those in the same act? All those and more. Both know by now that what's under discussion is the act of suicide, which also includes bestiality. Think how sweet, runs the pitch, to show mercy, sexual mercy, to that hurt and crying animal. Pedophilia. It is widely reported that just at the edge you grow glaringly younger. Lesbianism. Yes, for as the wind blows through all the emptying compartments, the two shadow women at last can creep out of their chambers in the dying shell at the last ashen shoreline to meet and embrace. Caprophilia. And urolagnia, the final convulsions. Fetishism, a wide choice of death fetishes, naturally. Naturally. The two of them sit there, passing a cigarette back and forth till it's smoked down to a very small stub. Is it idle talk? Or is Ombindi really trying to hustle Enzian here? Enzian's got to be sure before he moves. If he comes out, says, this is a hustle, right, and turns out it isn't, well, but the alternative is so strange that Ensign is, in some way, being sold on suicide. Well, I don't care for the things I eat. Can't stand that boogie-woogie beat, but I'm sold on suicide. You can keep their bingo, too, and that darn boo-boo-boo-boo, 'cause I'm sold on suicide. Oh, I'm not too keen on ration stamps or mothers who used to be baby vamps, but I'm sold on suicide. Don't like either the cards or browns. Piss on the country and piss on the town. But I'm S.O.S. Yes, well, actually, this goes on verse after verse for quite some time. In its complete version, it represents a pretty fair enunciation of the things of the world. The trouble with it is that by Gödel's theorem, there is bound to be some item around that one has omitted from the list, and such an item is not easy to think of off the top of one's head, so that what one does most likely is go back over the whole thing, meantime correcting mistakes and inevitable repetitions, and putting in new items that will surely have occurred to one, and, well, it's easy to see that the suicide of the title might have to be postponed indefinitely. Conversations between Ombindi and Ensign these days are thus a series of commercial messages, with Ensign not so much Mark as unwilling shill, standing in for the rest of the tip, who may be listening and maybe not.
Ah, do I see your cock growing in Gwalaleru? No, no, perhaps you are only thinking of someone you loved somewhere long ago, back in Sudwest, eh? To allow the tribal past to disperse all memories ought to be public record. There's no point in preserving history with that final zero to look forward to. Cynically, though, Ombindi has preached this in the name of the old tribal unity, and it's a weakness in his pitch, all right. It looks bad. Looks like Ombindi's trying to make believe the Christian sickness never touched us, when everyone knows it has infected us all, some to death. Yes, it is a little bit jive of Ombindi here to look back toward an innocence he's really only heard about, can't himself believe in, the gathered purity of opposites, the village built like a mandala, still he will profess and proclaim it as an image of a grail slipping through the room. Radiant, though the jokers around the table be sneaking whoopee cushions into the siege perilous, under the very descending arse of the grail seeker, and though the grails themselves come in plastic these years, a dime a dozen, penny a gross, still Umbindi, at times self-conned as any Christian, praises and prophesies that era of innocence he just missed living in. One of the last pockets of pre-Christian oneness left on the planet. Tibet is a special case. Tibet was deliberately set aside by the Empire as free and neutral territory, as Switzerland for the spirit where there is no extradition, and Alp Himalayas to draw the soul upward and danger rare enough to tolerate. Switzerland and Tibet are linked along one of the true meridians of Earth. True as the Chinese have drawn meridians of the body, we will have to learn such new maps of Earth, and as travel in the interior becomes more common, as the maps grow another dimension, so must we. And he tells, too, of Gondwanaland, before the continents drifted apart when Argentine lay snuggled up to Sudwest. The people listen and filter back to cave and bed and family calabash from which the milk unconsecrated is swallowed in cold whiteness, cold as the north. So, between these two, even routine greeting does not pass without some payload of meaningfulness and the hope of blitzing the other's mind. Ensign knows that he is being used for his name. The name has some magic, but he has been so unable to touch, so neutral for so long. Everything has flowed away but the name, Ensign, a sound for chanting. He hopes it will be magic enough for one thing, one good thing when the time comes, however short of the center. What are these persistences among a people, these traditions and offices, but traps? The sexual fetishes Christianity knows how to flash, to lure us in, meant to remind us of earliest infant love. Can his name, can Ensign break their power? Can his name prevail? The Erzschweinhöhle is in one of the worst traps of all, a dialectic of word made flesh, flesh moving toward something else. Ensign sees the trap clearly, but not the way out. Sitting now between a pair of candles just lit, his gray field jacket open at the neck, beard feathering down his dark throat to shorter, sparser, glossy black hairs that go running in a whirl, iron filings about the south pole of his Adam's apple, pole, axis, axle tree, tree, Omumborombanga, Mukuru, first ancestor, Adam. Still sweating, hands from the working day gone graceless and numb, he has a minute to drift and remember this time of day back in Sudvest, above ground, participating in the sunset, out watching the mist gather, part fog, part dust from the cattle returning to the kraals to milking and sleep. His tribe believed long ago that each sunset is a battle. In the north, where the sun sets, live the one-armed warriors, the one-legged and one-eyed, who fight the sun each evening, who spear it to death, until its blood runs out over the horizon and sky. But under the earth, in the night, the sun is born again to come back each dawn, new and the same. But we, Zone Hereros, under the earth, how long will we wait in this north, this locus of death? Is it to be reborn? Or have we really been buried for the last time, buried facing north, like all the rest of our dead, and like all the holy cattle ever sacrificed to the ancestors? North is death's region. There may be no gods, but there is a pattern. Names by themselves may have no magic, but the act of naming, the physical utterance, obeys the pattern. Nordhausen means dwellings in the north. The rocket had to be produced out of a place called Nordhausen. The town adjoining was named Bleicherode as a validation, a bit of redundancy so that the message would not be lost. The history of the old Hereros is one of lost messages. It began in mythical times, when the sly hare, who nests in the moon, brought death among men, instead of the moon's true message. The true message has never come. Perhaps the rocket is meant to take us there someday, and then moon will tell us its truth at last. There are those down in the Erdscheinhöhle, younger ones, who've only known white, autumn-prone Europe, who believe moon is their destiny. But older ones can remember that moon, like Njambi Karunga, is both the bringer of evil and its avenger. And Enzians found the name Bleicherode close enough to Blicker, the nickname the early Germans gave to death. They saw him white, bleaching and blankness. The name was later Latinized to Dominus Blickero. Weismann, enchanted, took it as his SS code name. Enzian was in Germany by then. Weismann brought the new name home to his pet, not showing it off so much as indicating to Enzian yet another step to be taken toward the rocket, toward a destiny he still cannot see past this sinister cryptography of naming, a sparse pattern but one that harshly will not be denied, that cries and nags him on, stumbling as badly as 20 years ago. Once he could not imagine a life without return. Before his conscious memories began, something took him in and out of his mother's circular village far out in the cacao veldt, at the borders of the land of death, a departure and a return. He was told about it years later. Shortly after he was born, his mother brought him back to her village, back from Svakopmund. In ordinary times, she would have been banished. She'd had the child out of wedlock by a Russian sailor whose name she couldn't pronounce. But under the German invasion, protocol was less important than helping one another, though the murderers in blue came down again and again. Each time, somehow, Enzian was passed over. It is a Herod myth his admirers still like to bring up to his annoyance. He had been walking only for a few months when his mother took him with her to join Samuel Maherero's great trek across the Kalahari. Of the stories told about these years, this is the most tragic. The refugees had been on the desert for days. Kama, king of the Bechuanas, sent guides, oxen, wagons, and water to help them. Those who arrived first were warned to take water only little by little. But by the time the stragglers arrived, everyone else was asleep. No one to warn them. Another lost message. They drank till they died. Hundreds of souls. Enzian's mother was among them. He had fallen asleep under a cowhide, exhausted from hunger and thirst. He woke among the dead. It is said that he was found there by a band of Ovajimba, taken and cared for. They left him back at the edge of his mother's village to walk in alone. They were nomads. They could have taken any other direction in that waste country, but they brought him back to the place he'd left. He found hardly anyone remaining there. Many had gone on the trek. Some had been taken away to the coast and herded into kraals or to work on the railroad the Germans were building through the desert. Many others had died eating cattle, dead of Rinderpest. No return. 60% of the Herero people had been exterminated. The rest were being used like animals. Enzian grew up into a white-occupied world. Captivity, sudden death, one-way departures were the ordinary things of every day. By the time the question occurred to him, he could find no way to account for his own survival. He could not believe in any process of selection. Njambi Karunga and the Christian God were too far away. There was no difference between the behavior of a god and the operations of pure chance. Weismann, the European whose protege he became, always believed he'd seduced Enzian away from religion. But the gods had gone away themselves. The gods had left the people. He let Weismann think what he wanted to. The man's thirst for guilt was insatiable as the deserts for water. It's been a long time now since the two men have seen each other. Last time they spoke was during the move from Peenemünde down here to the Mittelwerke. Weismann is probably dead by now. Even in Südwest, 20 years ago, before Enzian could even speak his language, he'd seen that. A love for the last explosion, the lifting and the scream that peaks past fear. Why should Weismann want to survive the war? Surely he'd have found something splendid enough to match his thirst. It could not have ended for him rationalized and meek as his 100 glass bureaus about the SS circuit, located in time and space always just to miss grandeur, only to be in its vacuum, to be tugged slightly along by its slipstream, but finally left to lie still again in a few tarnished sequins of wake. Bürgerlichkeit played to Wagner, the brasses faint and mocking, the voices of the strings drifting in and out of phase. At night down here, very often lately, Entheon will wake for no reason. Was it really him, pierced Jesus, who came to lean over you? The white faggot's dream body, the slender legs and soft gold European eyes? Did you catch a glimpse of olive cock under the ragged loincloth? Did you want to reach to lick at the sweat of his rough, his wooden bondage? Where is he? What part of our zone tonight? Damn him to the knob of that nervous imperial staff. There are few such islands of down and velvet for him to lie and dream on, not in these marble passages of power. Entheon has grown cold, not so much a fire dying away as a positive coming on of cold, a bitter taste growing across the palate of love's first hopes. It began when Weismann brought him to Europe, a discovery that love, among these men, once past the simple feel and orgasming of it, had to do with masculine technologies, with contracts, with winning and losing. Demanded, in his own case, that he enter the service of the rocket. Beyond simple steel erection, the rocket was an entire system, one, away from the feminine darkness, held against the entropies of lovable but scatterbrained Mother Nature. That was the first thing he was obliged by Weismann to learn, his first step toward citizenship in the zone. He was led to believe that by understanding the rocket, he would come to understand truly his manhood. I used to imagine in some naive way I have lost now that all the excitement of those days was being put on for me, somehow, as a gift from Weismann. He had carried me over his threshold and into his house, and this was the life he meant to bring me to. These manly pursuits, devotion to the leader, political intrigue, secret rearming and naughty defiance of the aging plutocracies all around us. They were growing impotent, but we were young and strong. To be that young and strong at such a time in the life of a nation. I could not believe so many fair young men, the way the sweat and dust lay on their bodies as they lengthened the autobahns day into ringing day. We drove among trumpeters, silk banners impeccably tailored as suits of clothes. The women seemed to move all docile, without color. I thought of them in ranks, down on all fours, having their beasts milked into pails of shining steel. Was he ever jealous of the other young men, the way you felt about them? Oh, it was still very physical for me then. But he had already moved past that part of it. No. No, I don't think he minded. I loved him then. I could not see into him, or the things he believed in, but I wanted to. If the rocket was his life, then I would belong to the rocket. And you never doubted him? He certainly hadn't the most ordered personality. Listen, I don't know how to say this. Have you ever been a Christian?
Well,
at one time, did you ever in the street see a man that you knew, in the instant, must be Jesus Christ, not hoped he was, or caught some resemblance, but knew? The deliverer returned and walking among the people just the way the old stories promised. As you approached, you grew more and more certain. You could see nothing at all to contradict that first amazement. You drew near and passed, terrified that he would speak to you. Your eyes grappled. It was confirmed. And most terrible to all, he knew. He saw into your soul. All your make-believe ceased to matter.
Then what's happened since your first days in Europe could be described in Max Weber's phrase almost as a routinization of charisma?
Autase, says Entheon, which is one of many Herrero words for shit, in this case a large newly laid cow turd. Andreas Orukambe sits in front of any army green, wrinkle-finished transmitter receiver rig off in a rock alcove of the room. A pair of rubber headphones covers his ears. The Schwarzkommando use the 50-centimeter band,
the one the rocket's Hawaii 2 guidance operated on, who but rocket maniacs would listen in at 53 centimeters? Schwarzkommando can be sure, at least, that they're being monitored by every competitor in the zone. Transmissions from the Erdschweinhörer begin around 0300 and run till dawn. Other Schwarzkommando stations broadcast on their own schedules. Traffic is in Herero with a German loan word now and then, which is too bad since these are usually technical words and valuable clues for whoever's listening. Andreas is on the second dog watch now, copying mostly, answering when he has to. Keying any transmitter is an invitation to instant paranoia. There springs into being an antenna pattern, thousands of square kilometers full of enemies out in their own night encampments in the zone, faceless, monitoring. Though they are in contact with one another, the Schwarzkommando try to listen in to as much as they can. Though there can be no illusion about their plans for the Schwarzkommando, still they are holding off, waiting for the optimum time to move in and destroy without a trace. Enzian believes they will wait for the first African rocket to be fully assembled and ready for firing. It will look better if they move against a real threat, real hardware. Meantime, Enzian tries to keep security tight. Here at the home base, it's no problem. Penetration by less than a regiment would be impossible. But farther out in the zone, rocket towns like Tzela, Enschede, Hachenburg, they can pick us off out there one by one. First a campaign of attrition, then a coordinated raid, leaving then only this metropolis under siege to strangle. Perhaps it's theater, but they seem no longer to be allies, though the history they have invented for themselves conditions us to expect post-war rivalries, when in fact it may all be a giant cartel, including winners and losers both, in an amiable agreement to share what is there to be shared. Still, Enzian has played them off. The quarreling scavengers, one against the other, it looks genuine enough. Marvi must be together with the Russians by now, and with General Electric, too. Throwing him off the train the other night bought us what? A day or two. And how well have we used the time? It comes down to this day-to-day knitting and unraveling. Minor successes, minor defeats. Thousands of details, any one of which carries the chance of a fatal mistake. Enzian would like to be more out of the process than he is, to be able to see where it's going, to know in real time at each splitting of the pathway of decision which would have been right and which wrong. But it is their time, their space, and he still expects, naively, out comes the white continuum group past hoping for centuries ago. The details, valves, special tools that may or may not exist, Erdschweinhörer jealousies and plots, lost operating manuals, technicians on the run from both east and west, food shortages, sick children, swirl like fog, each particle with its own array of forces and directions. He can't handle them all at the same time. If he stays too much with any, he's in danger of losing others. But it's not only the details. He has the odd feeling in moments of reverie or honest despair that he is speaking lines prepared somewhere far away. Not far away in space, but in levels of power. And that his decisions are not his own at all, but the flummeries of an actor impersonating a leader. He has dreamed of being held in the pitiless emprise of something from which he cannot wake. He is often aboard a ship on a broad river, leading a rebellion which must fail. For reasons of policy, the rebellion is being allowed to go on for a bit. He is being hunted. His days are full of narrow escapes, which he finds exciting, physically graceful. And the plot itself, it has a stern and intense beauty. It is music, a symphony of the north, of an Arctic voyage, past headlands of very green ice, to the feet of icebergs, kneeling in the grip of this incredible music, washed in seas blue as blue dye, an endless north, vast country, settled by people whose old culture and history are walled off by a great silence from the rest of the world. The names of their peninsulas and seas, their long and powerful rivers, are unknown down in the temperate world. It is a return, this voyage. He has grown old inside his name. The sweeping music of the voyage is music he wrote himself so long ago that he has forgotten it completely. But now, it is finding him again. Trouble in Hamburg. Andreas is scribbling away, lifting one earpiece back, smock, damp with sweat so that he can be on both ends of the link at once. Sounds like it might be the DPs again. Got a bad signal. Keeps fading. Since the surrender, there have been these constant skirmishes between the German civilians and foreign prisoners freed from the camps. Towns in the north have been taken over by displaced Poles, Czechs, Russians, who've looted the arsenals and granaries and mean to hold what they've taken. But nobody knows how to feel about the local Schwarzkommando. Some see only the ragged pieces of SS uniform and respond to that one way or another. Others take them for Moroccans or Indians drifted somehow over the mountains from Italy. Germans still remember the occupation of the Rhineland 20 years ago by French colonial units and the posters screaming, Schwarze Besatzung am Rhein. Another stress in the pattern. Last week in Hamburg, 2 Schwarzkommando were shot. Others were badly beaten. The British military government sent in some troops, but only after the killing was over. Their main interest seemed to be in enforcing a curfew. It's Anguruve. Andreas hands over the earphones and swivels to roll out of Enzian's way. Can't tell if it's us they want or the oil refinery. The voice goes crackling in and out. 100, maybe 200, so many. Fools, clubs, handguns. Bleep and a burst of hissing, then in laps a familiar voice. I can bring 12 men. Hanover's answering, Enzian murmurs, trying to sound amused. You mean Josef Umbindi? Andreas is not amused. Now Anguruve calling for help is neutral on the empty ones question, or tries to be. But if Umbindi can bring a relief force to Hamburg, he may decide to stay. Hanover, even with the Volkswagen plant, there is only a stepping stone for him. Hamburg would give the empty ones a stronger power base. And this could be the opportunity. The North ought to be their native element anyway. I'll have to go, handing the phones back to Andreas. What's wrong? Could be the Russians trying to draw you out. It's all right. Stop worrying about Chicherinya. I don't think he's up there. But your European said, him, I don't know how far to trust him. Remember, I did hear him talking with Marvi on the train. Now he's with Chicherinya's girl in Nordhaus, and I mean, would you trust him? But if Marvi's chasing him now, it might mean he's worth something. If he is, we're sure to see him again. Anthean grabs his kit, swallows 2 Pervitins for the road, reminds Andreas of a business detail or two for tomorrow, and climbs the long salt and stone ramps to the surface. Outside, he breathes the evergreen air of the Harz. In the old villages, it will be the time of evening for the milking. The first star is out, Okanumaihi, the little drinker of sweet milk. But this must be a different star, a northern star. There is no comfort. What has happened to us? If choices have never been our own, if the Zone Hereros are meant to live in the bosom of the angel who tried to destroy us in Südwest, then have we been passed over, or have we been chosen for something even more terrible? Enzian has to be in Hamburg before another spearing of the sun. Security on the trains is troublesome, but the sentries know him. The long freights are rolling out from the Mittelwerke day and night, carrying A4 hardware west to the Americans, north to the English, and soon, when the new map of the occupation goes into effect, east to the Russians, too. Nordhausen will be under Russian administration, and we should have some action then. Will it give him a chance at Chicherinya? Enzian has never seen the man, but they are meant to come together. Enzian is his half-brother. They have the same flesh. His sciatic nerve is throbbing now, too much sitting. He goes limping, alone, head still down for the low clearances back down in the Erzschweinhöhle. Who knows what waits out here for the head held too high? Down the road to the railway overpass, tall and gray in the growing starlight, Enzian is heading into the north. Just before dawn, 100 feet below flows a pallid sheet of cloud, stretching west as far as they can see. Here are Slothrop and the apprentice witch, gaily tripping, standing up on top of the Brocken, the very plexus of German evil, 20 miles north by northwest of the Mittelwerke, waiting for the sun to rise. Though May Day eves come and gone, and this frolicking twosome are nearly a month late, relics of the latest Black Sabbath still remain. Kriegsbier empties, lace undergarments, spent rifle cartridges, swastika banners of ripped red satin, tattooing needles and splashes of blue ink. What the heck was that for? Slothrop wondered.
for the devil's kiss, of course. Gaily snuggling, oh, you old silly, up to his armpit there, and Slothrop feeling a little icky and square for not knowing. But then he knows next to nothing about witches, even though there was in his ancestry one genuine Salem witch, one of the last to join the Susperquahal crowd, dangling, several of them back through the centuries couplings, off of the Slothrop family tree. Her name was Amy Sprue, a family renegade turned antinomian at age 23, and running mad over the Berkshire countryside, ahead of crazy Sue Dunham by 200 years, stealing babies, riding cows in the twilight, sacrificing chickens up on Snod's Mountain. A lot of ill will about those chickens, as you can imagine. The cows and babies always somehow came back all right. Amy Sprue was not, like young, skipping Dorothy's antagonist, a mean witch. She headed for Rhode Island, seeking some of that asylum, and she thought she'd stop by Salem on her way. But they didn't like her style, and they didn't like her smile, so she never saw that Narragansett Bay. They busted her for witchery, and she got death. Another of Slothrop's crazy kinfolks. When she was mentioned aloud at all, it was with a shrug. Too far away, really, to be a family disgrace, more of a curiosity. Slothrop grew up not quite knowing what to think about her. Witches were certainly not getting a fair shake in the 30s. They were depicted as hags who called you dearie, not exactly a wholesome lot. The movies had not prepared him for this Teutonic version here. Your kraut witch, for example, has 6 toes on each foot and no hair at all on her cunt. That is how the witches look, anyhow, in the stairway murals inside the one-time Nazi transmitter tower up on the Brocken here, and government murals are hardly places to go looking for irresponsible fantasy, right? But Gailey thinks the hairless cunt derives from the women von Beros drew. Oh, you just don't want to shave yours, crows Slothrop. Ha ha, some witch. I'll show you something, she says, which is why they are now awake at this ungodly hour, side by side, holding hands very still as the sun begins to clear the horizon. Now watch, Gailey whispers, out there. As the sunlight strikes their backs, coming in nearly flat on, it begins developing on the pearl cloud bank. 2 gigantic shadows, thrown miles overland, past Klaus Tautzelterfeld, past Zeisen and Goslar, across where the river Leine would be, and reaching toward Weser. By golly, Slothrop a little bit nervous, it's the specter. You got it up around Greylock in the Berkshires, too. Around these parts it is known as the Brockengespenst, God shadows. Slothrop raises an arm. His fingers are cities. His biceps is a province. Of course he raises an arm. Isn't it expected of him? The arm shadow trails rainbows behind as it moves, reaching eastward for a grab at Göttingen. Not ordinary shadows, either. 3-dimensional ones, cast out on the German dawn. Yes, and Titans had to live in these mountains or under them. Impossibly out of scale, never to be carried by a river. Never to look to a horizon and think that it might go on forever. No trees to climb, no long journeys to take. Only their deep images are left, haloed shells lying prone above the fogs men move in. Gailey kicks a leg out straight as a dancer and tilts her head to the side. Slothrop raises his middle finger to the west, the headlong finger darkening 3 miles of cloud per second. Gailey grabs for Slothrop's cock. Slothrop leans to bite Gailey's tit. They are enormous, dancing the floor of the whole visible sky. He reaches underneath her dress. She twines a leg around one of his. The spectra wash red to indigo, tidal, immense, at all their edges. Under the clouds out there, it's as still and lost as Atlantis. But the Brockengespenst phenomenon is confined to dawn's slender interface, and soon the shadows have come shrinking back to their owners. Say, did that Cicerini ever... Cicerini is too busy for this. Oh, and I'm some kind of a drone or something. You're different. Well, he ought to see it. She looks at him curiously, but doesn't ask why. Her teeth halt on her lower lip, and the varum, varum, a plastic man sound, hovers trapped in her mouth. Just as well. Slothrop doesn't know why. He's no help to anybody who's fixing to interrogate. Last night he and Gailey blundered onto a Schwarzkommando picket outside one of the old mine entrances. The Hereros threw questions at him for an hour. Oh, just wondering about, you know, looking for a bit of the odd, what we call human interest, fascinating. Of course, we're always interested in what you chaps are up to. Gailey snickering in the darkness. They must have known her.
They didn't ask her anything. When he brought it up later, she wasn't sure just what this is between Chichirinya and the Africans, but whatever it is, it's being carried on with high passion.
It's hate, all right, she said. Stupid, stupid. The war's over. It isn't politics or fuck your buddy. It's old-time, pure personal hate.
Entian?
I think so.
They found the Brocken, occupied both by American and by Russian troops. The mountain lay on what was to be the border of the Soviet zone of occupation. The brick and stucco ruins of the radio transmitter and a tourist hotel loomed up just outside the firelight. Only a couple of platoons here, nobody higher than non-coms. The officers were all down in Bad Harzburg, Halberstadt, someplace comfortable, getting drunk or laid. There is a certain air of resentment up on the Brocken, all right, but the boys like Gailey and tolerate Slothrop, and luckiest of all, nobody seems to be connected with that ordnance. It's only a moment's safety, though. Major Marvey is gnashing about the hearts, sending thousands of canaries into cardiac episodes, dropping in yellow droves belly up out of the trees as he marauds on by hollering, "Git, that limey sucker. I don't care how many men it takes, I want a fucking division, you hear me, boy? Only a matter of time before he picks up the trail again. He's out of his mind." Slothrop's a little daffy, but not like this. This is really unhealthy, this Marvey persecution. Is it possible? Yep, the thought has certainly occurred to him that Marvey's in tight with those Rolls-Roycers who were after him in Zurich. There may be no limit to their connections. Marvey is buddies with GE, that's Morgan money. There's Morgan money in Harvard and surely an interlock someplace with Lyle Bland. Who are they, hey? Why do they want Slothrop? He knows now for sure that Zwitter, the mad Nazi scientist, is one of them. And that kindly old Professor Glimpf was only waiting down in the Mittelwerke to pick up Slothrop if he showed. Jesus. If Slothrop hadn't snuck out after dark back down into Nordhausen to Gailey's place, they'd have him locked up by now for sure, maybe beaten up, maybe dead. Before they head back down the mountain, they manage to chisel 6 cigarettes and some K-rations off of the sentries. Gailey knows a friend of a friend who stays out on a farm in the Golden Hour, a ballooning enthusiast named Schnorp, who is heading toward Berlin.
But I don't want to go to Berlin.
You want to go where Marvey isn't, Liebchen. Schnorp is beaming, eager enough for company, just back from a local PX with an armload of flat white boxes, merchandise he plans to move in Berlin. No trouble, he tells Slothrop. Don't worry, I've done this trip hundreds of times. Nobody bothers a balloon. He takes Slothrop out in back of the house, and here in the middle of a sloping green field is a wicker gondola beside a great heap of bright yellow and scarlet silk. Real unobtrusive getaway, Slothrop mutters. A gang of kids have appeared running out of an apple orchard to help them carry 10 jerry cans of grain alcohol out to the gondola. All shadows are being thrown uphill by the afternoon sun. Wind blows from the west. Slothrop gives Schnorp a light from his Zippo to get the burner going while kids straighten out the folds in the gas bag. Schnorp turns up the flame till it's shooting sideways and with a steady roar into the opening of the great silk bag. Children visible through the gap break up into wiggly heat waves. Slowly the balloon begins to expand.
Remember me, Gailey calls above the rumbling of the burner, till I see you again.
Slothrop climbs in the gondola with Schnorp. The balloon rises a little off the ground and is caught by the wind. They start to move. Gailey and the kids have taken hold of the gondola all around its gunwales, the bag still not all the way up but gathering speed, dragging them all as fast as their feet can move, giggling and cheering uphill. Slothrop keeps as much out of the way as he can, letting Schnorp see that the flames pointed into the bag and that lines to the basket are clear. At last, the bag swings vertical across the sun, the inside of it going a riotous wreathing of yellow and scarlet heat. One by one, the ground crew fall away, waving goodbye. The last to go is Gailey in her white dress, hair brushed back over her ears into pigtails, her soft chin and mouth and big, serious eyes looking into Slothrop's for as long as she can before she has to let go. She kneels in the grass, blows a kiss. Slothrop feels his heart, out of control, inflate with love, and rise quick as a balloon. It is taking him longer, the longer he's in the zone, to remember to say, "Aw, quit being a sap." What is this place doing to his brain? They soar up over a stand of firs. Gailey and the children go dwindling to shadow strokes on the green lawn. The hills fall away, flatten out. Soon, looking back, Slothrop can see Nordhausen, Cathedral, Rathaus, Church of St. Blasius, the roofless quarter where he found Gailey. Schnorp nudges and points. After a while, Slothrop makes out a convoy of four olive drab vehicles dusting along toward the farm in a hurry. Marvie's mother's, by the looks of things. And Slothrop hanging from this gaudy beach ball. Well, all right. I'm bad luck, Slothrop hollers over a little later. They've found a steady course now northeastward and are huddling close to the alcohol flame, collars turned up. With a gradient of must be 50 degrees between the wind at their backs and the warmth in front. I should have mentioned that. You don't even know me, and here we're flying into that Russian zone. Schnorp, his hair blown like holidays of hay, does a wistful German thing with his upper lip. There are no zones, he says, which is also a line of Gailey's. No zones, but the zone. Before too long, Slothrop has begun checking out these boxes here that Schnorp brought along. There are a dozen of them, and each contains a deep golden custard pie, which will fetch a fantastic price in Berlin. Wow, cries Slothrop. Holy shit, surely I hallucinate, and other such eager junior sidekick talk. You ought to have a PX card, the sales pitch. Right now I can't afford a ration stamp for an aunt's jockstrap, replies Slothrop forthrightly. Well, I'll split this one pie here with you, Schnorp reckons after a time, because I'm getting kind of hungry. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, Slothrop is just chowing on that pie, enjoying himself, licking custard off his hands, when he happens to notice off in the sky, back toward Nordhausen, this funny dark object the size of a dot. Schnorp looks around. Cut! Comes up with a brass telescope and braces it, blazing on the gunwale. Cut! Cut! No markings. I wonder... Out of air so blue you can take it between your fingers, rub and bring them back blue, they watch the dot slowly grow into a rusty old reconnaissance plane. Presently they can hear its engine, snarling and sputtering. Then, as they watch, it banks and starts a pass. Along the wind between them faintly comes the singing of furies. There was a young man named McGuire who was fond of the pitch amplifier, but a number of shorts left him covered with warts and set half the bedroom on fire. Ya, 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 ya. In Prussia they never eat pussy. The plane buzzes by a yard or two away, showing its underbelly. It is a monster about to give birth. Out of a little access opening peers a red face in leather helmet and goggles. You limey sucker, going past. We fixin' to hand your ass to you. Without planning to, Slothrop has picked up a pie. Fuck you, he flings it, perfect shot, the plane peeling slowly past, and blop gets Marvie right in the face. Yeah, gloved hands, paw at the mess. The major's pink tongue appears. Custard drips into the wind, yellow droplets fall in long arcs toward earth. The hatch closes as the recon plane slides away, slow rolls, circles, and heads back. Schnorp and Slothrop heft pies and wait. There's no cowling around that engine, Schnorp has noticed, so we'll aim for that. Now they can see the dorsal side of the plane, its cockpit jammed to capacity with beer-sodden Americans singing, There once was a fellow named Ritter who slept with a guidance transmitter. It shriveled his cock, which fell off in his sock and made him exceedingly bitter. 100 yards and closing fast. Schnorp grabs Slothrop's arm and points off to starboard. Providence has contrived to put in their way a big white slope of cloud, and the wind is bringing them swiftly into it. The seething critter puts out white tentacles, beckoning, hurry, hurry, and they are inside then, inside its wet and icy reprieve. Now they'll wait. No, Schnorp cupping an ear, they've cut the motor, they're in here with us. The swaddled silence goes on for a minute or two, but sure enough, there once was a fellow named Schroeder who buggered the vane servo motor. He soon grew a prong on the end of his schlong and hired himself a promoter. Schnorp is fiddling with the flame, a rose-gray nimbus, trying for less visibility but not too much loss of altitude. They float in their own one sphere of light without coordinates. Outcrops of granite smash blindly upward like fists into the cloud, trying to find the balloon. The plane is somewhere with its own course and speed. There is no action the balloon can take. Binary decisions have lost meaning in here. The cloud presses in, suffocating. It condenses in fat drops on top of the pies. Suddenly, raucous and hungover, there was a young man from Decatur who slept with a LOX generator. His balls and his prick froze solid real quick and his asshole a little bit later. Curtains of vapor drift back to reveal the Americans, volplaning along well inside 10 meters and only a little faster than the balloon.
Now! Schnorp yells, heaving a pie at the exposed engine. Slothrop misses and splatters all over the windscreen in front of the pilot, by which time Schnorp has commenced flinging ballast bags at the engine, leaving one stuck between two of the cylinders. The Americans, by surprise, reach in confusion for sidearms, grenades, machine guns, whatever it is your ordnance types carry around in the way of light armament. But they have glided on past, and now the fog closes in again. There are a few shots. Shit, man, if they hit that bag... Shh, I think we got the wire from the booster magneto. Off in the middle of the cloud can be heard the nagging whicker of an engine refusing to start. Linkage squeaks desperately. Oh, fuck! A muffled scream far away. The intermittent whining grows fainter until there is silence. Schnorp is lying on his back, slurping pie, laughing bitterly. Half of his inventory's been thrown away, and Slothrop feels a little guilty. No, stop worrying. This is like the very earliest days of the mercantile system. We're back to that again, a second chance. Passages are long and hazardous. Loss in transit is a part of life. You have had a glimpse of the Urmacht. When the clouds fall away a few minutes later, they find themselves floating quietly under the sun. Shrouds dripping, gas bags still shiny with the moist cloud, no sign at all of Marvy's plane. Schnorp adjusts the flame. They begin to rise. Toward sundown, Schnorp gets thoughtful. Look, you can see the edge of it. At this latitude, the Earth's shadow races across Germany at 650 miles an hour, the speed of a jet aircraft. The cloud sheet has broken up into little fog blankets the color of boiled shrimp. The balloon goes drifting over countryside whose green patchwork the twilight is now urging toward black. The thread of a little river flaming in the late sun, the intricate angled pattern of another roofless town. The sunset is red and yellow, like the balloon. On the horizon, the mild sphere goes warping down, a peach on a china plate. The farther south you go, Schnorp continues, the faster the shadow sweeps till you reach the equator, 1,000 miles an hour. Fantastic, it breaks through the speed of sound somewhere over southern France, around the latitude of Carcassonne. The wind is bundling them on, north by east. Southern France, Slothrop remembers then. Yeah, that's where I broke through the speed of sound. The zone is in full summer. Souls are found quiescent behind the pieces of wall, fast asleep down curled in shell craters, out screwing under the culverts with gray shirt tails hoisted, adrift dreaming in the middles of fields. Dreaming of food, oblivion, alternate histories. The silences here are retreats of sound, like the retreat of the surf before a tidal wave. Sound draining away down slopes of acoustic passage to gather someplace else to a great surge of noise. Cows, big lummoxes splotched black and white, harnessed now for the plowing because German horses in the zone are all but extinct, will drudge with straight faces right on into minefields. Sown back in the winter. The god-awful blasts go drumming over the farmland. Horns, hide, and hamburger come showering down all over the place. The dented bells lie quiet in the clover. Horses might have known to keep clear, but the Germans wasted their horses, squandered the race, herding them into the worst of it, the swarms of steel, the rheumatic marshes, the unblanketed winter chills of our late fronts. A few might have found safety with the Russians who still care for horses. You hear them often in the evenings. Their campfires send up rays for miles from behind the stands of beech, through northern summer haze that's almost dry, only enough of it to give a knife's edge to the firelight. A dozen accordions and concertinas all going at once in shaggy chords with a reed ringing to it, and the songs full of plaintive stiez and sneez with the voices of the girl auxiliaries clearest of all. The horses whicker and move in the rustling grass. The men and women are kind, resourceful, fanatical. They are the most joyous of the zone's survivors. In and out of all the vibrant flesh moves the mad scavenger, Chicherinje, who is more metal than anything else. Steel teeth wink as he talks. Under his pompadour is a silver plate. Gold wirework threads and three-dimensional tattoo among the fine wreckage of cartilage and bone inside his right knee joint, the shape of it always felt Payne's hand-fashioned seal, and his proudest battle decoration, because it is invisible and only he can feel it. A 4-hour operation, and in the dark, it was the Eastern Front. There were no sulfa drugs, no anesthesia. Of course he's proud. He has marched here with his limp as permanent gold, out of coldness, meadows. Officially, he reports to TSAGI, which is the Central Aero and Hydrodynamics Institute in Moscow. His orders mention technical intelligence, but his real mission in the zone is private, obsessive, and not, so his superiors have let him know in a number of delicate ways, in the people's interest. Chicherinya guesses that this, taken literally, may be true enough, but he is not sure about the interests of those who warned him. They could have their own reasons for wanting Enzian liquidated in spite of what they say. Their differences with Chicherinya may be over the timing or the motives. Chicherinya's motives are not political. His building in the German vacuum ended on a compulsive need he has given up trying to understand. A need to annihilate the Schwarzkommando and his mythical half-brother Enzian. He comes from nihilist stock. There are in his ancestry any bonds. He is no relation to the Chicherinya who dealt a treaty with Walter Rathenau. There was a long-term operator, a Menshevik turned exile, and his return, believe them all, were somewhere in his seat. That if some men sleep and arms that have opened maniacally to death, faithful network of Fräuleins around the zone, even when the intelligence hazards of love, of attachment, are still light when balanced against what he has to do. Nation can sweat in the winter, sticky tea glasses, and step to piss. It was a land of drunk the cities, silent, truly speech, gesture, touch among Moscow as the red jorts. Young smear chokmas were almost as strange to the Russian cadre. Tall prince thought of it this way. Represent TA, new Turkic alphabet, uncommonly alien country. Chernya will usually mosey down to the red jort there to look in on that gal who appeals to what must be a kid or two in his personality. Well, then he'll come outside to find his more skies full of sheet lighting, glaring, awful. Except that it is a fairly average day for pulse after heaven vision above the sleeping desyatinas of grasses, of mullein stalks, rippling out of sight. In the street, out in it, hitching his pack, whipped rattling against his chest, army here. He will not come to love this sky or plain, these people, their animals. And in the worst marsh bivouacs of his soul, in naked Leningrad and Kath, of the deaths of comrades, never keep any memory of seven no, against the step. Already she is more like the shape of a procedure for field stripping, back trigger with four, as your bolt with right, interlocking precautions, part of a prop, Duba Chicherinya. Working out its changes, its little dialectic, until it ends, with nothing, the structure. Her eyes hide in ice, orbits darkened as is small, square, veered forward, the lower teeth more apt to show when she, for a smile, bones strongly curved and welded. Her aura is chalk dust, laundry soap. With desperate Yuba about the edge of the room at her window, a pretty hawk, a Yuba who flows the first long dive, the talon shock and the blood while her lean low in the at white words. Light pulses behind the clouds. Chichi street into the sir gets a blush from Nuba, a kind of cowdmical Chinese swamp urchin. Stares from an early pupil or two. Native school teacher, Jakin, up from a crest's black theodolites, bootlaces, tractor gaskets, plugs, greasy ends, steel, 7.62-millimeter round Yoshka, about to ask for a cigarette which is already out of Chicherinya's and en route. He'd better. He's not Chicherinya's, much less the Russian's friendship. Ulan's father was killed during the 1960s, trying to get away from one of about 100 fleeing Kyrgyz massacred one evening peaceable somehow north to the zero at the top of the world. Russians settled the darker refugees, pitchforks, old right, any weapon to hand. A common occurrence in Semyuritch. Then, even that from the Antetachs, Kyrgyz, and Dungans, that told game. Daily scores were kept. It was a competition, good-natured, but more than play. Thousands of wrestlers bit the dust. There was even their numbers lost forever. Colors of skin became reason jail. Even speeches, because rumors of German agents swept along these plains, not without help from Petrograd. This native uprising was supposed to be the doing of an international conspiracy to open a new front war. More Western area, based solidly on the European Balkans, be Kazakh, Kyrgyz, Easterns. Hadn't the nationalities been happy? Hadn't 50 years of Russian rule brought progress? Well, for now,
Under the current dispensation in Moscow, Jakub Kulan is the son of a national martyr. The Tsar, power in Russia, ancient and absolute, kind to the nationalities. But though the lovable tyrant does what he can, as much a native as before, gauged day to day by these Russians as to his degree of restlessness. His sorrel face, his long narrow eyes, and the lonely hide tents out there among the resistances. Use him, that is, except look from Luba suggesting falconhood. Here, ships of seven rivers have not yet been alphabetized and perhaps never will be. They are at any time to come into a room, into a heart, returning all Soviet alternatives brought out here by the Likbez agents. T.A. cannot feel frightening as the elements in this bear's corner, while some are so pitiless. She had to come out here to learn what an earthquake felt like and how to wait out a sandstorm. What would it be out to a city? Often she will dream some dainty pasteboard model, a city planner's city, perfectly detailed, out neighborhoods. At the same time, she is also down inside, looking up, waiting, and the blows from the sky, drawn in whatever it is approaching, knowing, awful to say, it is herself, her central client self, aimless thing she fears. He's all these stormy. He is constant by her, westward, the African half-brother and his poetry books furrowed and settering burnt wood black, wait by one out across the unnumbered versts of lowland and of slants as their autumns come around again, leans along the planet's withers like an old circus rider, tries to catch their attention with nothing more than its public face, and continues to fail at each perfect pass around the ring. But didn't now and then, not often, across the paper schoolroom or by surprise in front of windows into the green deep open, give Chichen the look, say, nothing you do, nothing he does will help you in your mortality? And farther apart, why let it matter this much? Live, die someday, honorably, meanly, but not by... The life keeps bringing the same free advice, each time a little less hopefully. But neither brother can listen. The black must have found his own version of some native to German dreams of the tenth elegy angel coming, wing beats all ridges of waking, coming to trample spoorless the white of his facing east, the black face keeping winter embankment or earth-colored wall of a grange, Poland awaiting, just as Chinya grows each month now smooth at his westward flank, seeing history and geopolitics move them surely into confrontation as the radios go screaming higher. New pests in the night to the touch with hydro-age, mounting across the empty canyons and passes, skies in the day go thick, miles of falling canopies, white visions of rich men's heavenly jorts, gaming now and still awkward, but grow, each strewn pattern less and less at play. Out into the bones of the backlands ride Chichereny and his faithful Kyrgyz companion Jakub Kulan. Chichereny's horse is a version of himself, an Appaloosa from the United States Snake. Snake used to be some kind of remittance horse, being sent a check each, or if you enjoy paranoid systems, a horribly rational man to stay off of the U.S. rodeo circuits, where in those days the famous bucking bronco Midnight was flung men right and left into the sun-beat fences. But Snake, he's not night wild, methodically homicidal, were unpredictable. When you go to ride him, he may be in docile as a maiden. And again, with no warning, seized at last ruffling of a great sigh, he could kill you simply as the jerk of a tuck of a head toward the exact moment and spot on the ground that you'll cease to live. No way to... For months he can be no trouble at all. So far he's ignored. But he's tried for Jakub Kulan three times. Dumb luck preserved. The third time he actually hung on and rode the colt a long time down to a fair kind of obedience. But each time King Picket on the hillside, he carries, with his leather gear and his bit of three horses back, the doubt, the inconsolable chance Kyrgyz didn't really break him last time. That Snake is only waiting, hanging away from the road. Farther over, black and white stars explode down the Appaloosa's croup and haunch. At the center of each of these novae is a stark circle of vacuum, of no color,
into which midday Kyrgyz at the roadside have taken looks and grinned away with a turn of the head to the horizon behind. Strain the dynamics of oil and the ways. Snake has seen a lot of changes since Arabia, en route to Chichirinu, who may be his other half. Lot of horse thieves, hard riding, confiscation by this government and that, escapes into ever more remote country. This time, sound of hooves, birds big as turkeys, black and white with splashes of blood red all around the eyes, lumbering for the uplands. Snake is going out into what could be the lure of all. Hardly remembering now the water pipes, the oases crawling with smoke, the beard and barbed naked delight up into Caucasian foothills in the dark, carried by lust, by storm along street trail, only terminal grasslands. Shadows damping into wet forests on the night slowly disappears. Waiting out in yet is the for them, the unimagined creature of Owen dust with her buttocks arched skyward. First touch of him, spine, rock. Yuba simply meaning Chichirinu, and out to the wildest, and carrying on quiet expression under some official curse. The rumors are as extravagant as this country is listless. In the room the corporals talk about a woman, an amazing woman who wore camisoles of whited and shaved her perfect legs every morning all the groin. It's fucking Catherine, armed and brilliant, brought up to date. Her lovers ran from ministers down to the likes of Captain Chich, naturally her truest. While Neo-Potemkins ranged the deep Arctic, her skilled and technocratic wolves erecting settlements out of tundra, entire urban abstractions out of ice and snow, bold Chichirinu was back at the capital, snuggled away in her dacha, where they played at fisherman and fish, terrorist and state, explorer and edge of the wave-green world. When official attention was finally directed their way, it did not mean death for Chichirinu, not even exile, but a thinning out of career possibilities. That happened to be how the vectors ran in those days. Central Asia for a good or attaché someplace like Costa Rica, where he wishes it could be Costa Rica someday, a release from this shuffle. How he misses the sea, how he dreams of eyes dark and liquid as his own, colonial eyes, gazing down from balconies of rotting stone. Meanwhile, another rumor tells of his connection with the legendary Wimpe, the head sail arts IG. Because it is an IG representative abroad on German spies, reporting back to an office in Berlin known as U7. This story about Chichirinu is not so easy to believe. If it were literal, you would. There's no possible way his life could have been spared in favor of this somnambulism among the eastern garrison towns. Certainly he could have known Wimpe for a while ran man in the clock of enthusiasm. Charming, handsome in shelves or terraces of strength, amiable gray eyes, vertical granite quivered, chin incapable of fat, dark suits, immaculate silver studs, horsehide gleamed under the skylights in the czarist entrance halls and across the Soviet concrete, his specialty and in suggested faith. Think of chess. In his early days around the capital, looking for a comparison that Russians might take to, an extravagant game of chess, going on to show if his audience was receptive and reflexes, knew to steer automatically along lines of least in how each molecule had so many possibilities for bonding, bonds of different strength, the most the queen, the great Catherine of the periodic table, down to the little hydrogens and position of the chessboard game to dance figures in three dimensions, four if you like, and a radically different idea of what winning and losing meant. Schwärmerei, his home had muttered, by excuses to driven patience. But Chichirinu would have stayed. Foolish, he would have kept listening and egged the German on. How could they have failed? By and by, the affair in its repressed and bloodless way proceeded. The Soviet chain of command, solicitous any 19th-century family, would begin to take some part. Conservatory, Central Asia, but in soft intelligence. Before the watchers quite caught the heads angling inside the dark pockets of that index. Since his earliest detail man, expertise had been focused in cyclized benzylisocs. Those of major interest being the opium alkaloid and the riot rooms of office, a suite at an older hotel, full of samples. German in amazing profile for his face to come, a 2% solution of morphine. Dionine, We add on an ethyl group here to the morphine as use. Halopan and neopan, all mixtures of opium alkaloids as the soluble hydrochloride and phosphates. Here is eucodal, a codeine with gins, a hydroxyl, a hydride. Gesturing in the air around his basic fist, hanging off different parts of the moccasins, trappings and detailing were half the game. As the French do with their dresses, nicht a pretty buckle, there to help sell a sparer design. Ah, this, Trivaline. One of the jewels of his line. Morphine and caffeine and cocaine all in as the valerates. Valerian, yeah. Root and rye. You may have older relatives who took the nerve test. Mentor, you might say. Some trimming over these bare molecules. What did Cicerini have to say? Was Cicerini there at all? Sitting back in the dingy room while the lift cables slapped and creaked through the walls? And down in the street, rarely enough to matter, a droshky rattled whip-snapping over these black old cobbles? Or while snow beat at the grimy window. How far, in the eyes of those who would send him to Central Asia, was too far? Would his simple presence in these rooms have given him death automatically, or was there still, even at let him reply? But once the pain has been taken care of, the simple theory I have heard... He heard. Not the subtlest way to get into it. They must have known every standard opener there is. Some military men are only blunt of holding back. They will lead the charge themselves. It's magnificent, but it's not. Wait until the Eastern Front, his first action, will develop and has a military s'engage et puis envoi. And as for plunging ahead, well, that IG and hotel room may have been one of his earlier rehearsals. Cicerini has a way of getting together with undesirables, sub-rosa, counter-revolutionary odds and ends of humanity. He'd plan it any given time, and in the drift of things, in the dance of things, howsoever, others latch on, and the pharmacology of the Cicerini thus modified, its onwardly revealed side effects can't necessarily be calculated ahead of time. Chupiang, the Chinese factotum in the red jurt, knows something of this. The first day Cicerini came to report in to the place, Chupiang knew, and tripped over his mop, not so much to divert attention as to celebrate the meeting. Chupiang has a bond, or tea is a living monument to the success of British trade policy back during the last century. This classic hustle is still famous even today for the cold purity of its execution. Bring opium from India, introduce it into China. Howdy, Fang. This here's opium, opium. This is Fang. Ah, so, me eaty. No, ho, ho, Fang, you smoky, smoky, see? Pretty soon Fang's coming back for more and more, so you create an inelastic demand for the shit, get China to make it illegal, then sucker China into a couple, three disastrous wars over the right of your merchants to sell opium, which by now you are describing as sacred. End of side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over.